Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Economic resilience. Employers add more jobs to the nation's overall economy, even as the tech industry is hit with massive layoffs. Then, fighting power. In a new memoir, journalist and Nobel Peace Prize winner Maria Ressa explores how online misinformation has contributed to democracy's decline.
That is what gets the greatest distribution online. It's lies laced with anger and hate, fear, us against them. If you do this all the time, what kinds of societies do we create?
And it's Friday. Jonathan Capehart and David Brooks give their take on President Biden's pushing Democrats to shake up their presidential primary calendar for 2024. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour.
John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, fostering informed and engaged communities. More at kf.org.
And friends of the NewsHour. This program was made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
U.S. hiring remained strong in November in spite of slow economic growth and high inflation. The Labor Department reported that the economy added 263,000 jobs last month. That's down slightly from October's gain of 284,000. The unemployment rate also held steady at 3.7%. And average hourly pay rose 5.1% over a year ago. Democrats voted for a major shakeup to their presidential primary calendar. The Democratic National Committee Rules Panel picked South Carolina to be the first state to vote, followed by New Hampshire and Nevada a week later. President Biden had recommended the move to prioritize the party's diverse base, stripping Iowa of its traditional first-place status. The full DNC is expected to give final approval early next year. President Biden signed a bill today averting a rail strike that could have plunged the U.S. into a recession. It gives rail workers a pay raise but does not include paid sick leave. The president, a staunch union ally, acknowledged the bill is not perfect but insisted it was necessary to avoid an economic catastrophe.
Look, I know this bill doesn't have paid sick leave that these rail workers and, frankly, every worker in America deserves. But that fight isn't over. And I want to thank Congress, Democrats and Republicans, for acting so quickly. I know this was a tough vote for members of both parties. It was a tough for me, but it was the right thing to do at the moment.
The president said the strike could have caused some 750,000 job losses and triggered major supply chain disruptions during the holidays. InfoWars host Alex Jones filed for personal bankruptcy today in Texas. Jones had been ordered to pay families of Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting victims nearly $1.5 billion for falsely calling the massacre a hoax. A Connecticut attorney representing the victims' relatives called the filing a, quote, cowardly move. The European Union has reached a deal to cap the price of Russian oil exports at $60 a barrel. Hours later, Australia and the group of seven nations, which includes the U.S., also agreed on the same price cap. The move aims to limit Moscow's profits off of oil sales to curb its war in Ukraine, while also keeping Russian oil on the market. Meanwhile, the Kremlin rejected Western demands today to completely pull out of Ukraine as part of any future peace talks. It came a day after President Biden said that he'd be ready to speak with Moscow only if President Putin is serious about ending his war by withdrawing forces. Also, a top advisor to Ukraine's President Zelensky made a rare acknowledgment that they have lost up to 13,000 soldiers in the conflict since February. That's well below Western estimates. In Ethiopia, civilians are still being killed by Eritrean troops in the Tigray region. weeks after the two main warring parties had signed a peace agreement. The Tigray Emergency Center reported that at least 111 civilians died in Tigray and 103 others were injured, according to data compiled over 7 days in late November. Dozens of other people were kidnapped and hundreds of homes were destroyed. Back in this country, red-hot lava from the Mauna Loa volcanic eruption is inching toward a main highway on Hawaii's Big Island. A lava road blockage would create serious problems for residents who regularly use the island's main east-west road. Locals are bracing for a tough commute.
When I think about how it's going to affect me, it's really devastating. I know that I'll still be able to work, but it's going to be way harder. I don't know many people that have a four-hour commute and 8 hours in a day.
The U.S. Geological Survey estimates that it could be at least a week before the lava reaches the highway. Hawaii's National Guard is already looking to set up potential bypass routes. Twitter has suspended Ye, the rapper formerly known as Kanye West, after he tweeted a picture of a swastika merged with the Star of David. It is the second time this year that his account has been suspended over anti-Semitic comments. Twitter CEO Elon Musk said that Ye's swastika post violated the platform's rule against inciting violence. The last of Arizona's counties to certify its midterm election results did so late Thursday, but only after a court order. Republican officials in rural Cochise County had refused to finalize results after falsely citing issues with vote counting machines. They finally approved the vote count after a judge ruled that the county broke state law in defying Monday's deadline. And stocks were mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 35 points to close at 34,430. The Nasdaq fell 21 points, and the S&P 500 slipped 5. Still to come on the NewsHour, how Muslim American candidates made history in the midterms. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart dissect the latest political news and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The latest jobs report is further confirmation of a strong labor market in the U.S., one that may be slowing down but has proven more resilient than many have expected. Many sectors are continuing to add jobs, but that is not true in the tech sector, where a number of companies have announced layoffs. Our economics correspondent Paul Solomon looks at what that means for those workers and why the struggles in tech may not be as problematic for the wider economy as one would think.
7 weeks into her dream job as a software engineer at Meta, the company formerly known as Facebook, Julia Gonick was suddenly laid off.
It's like the ground just fell out from underneath me, and all of my opportunities and the future that I saw for myself just completely disappeared.
Now, the ink barely dry on her MIT diploma, the computer science major is looking for a new job.
The market is just not great right now, so that makes interviewing and looking for a new job more stressful, since you just don't know if there are jobs out there or if you can get a job that you would actually like to do and want to do.
Especially jobs that pay like big tech.
Software engineers at these big companies definitely make very good money right outside of college, definitely six figures starting salary.
Plus a signing bonus. 3 weeks ago, Gonick was one of 11,000 laid off at Meta without warning. 13% of the company, one of more than 140,000 tech workers who've already lost their jobs this year, making headlines worldwide. Especially worried, those on a work-sponsored visa, which allows them to remain in the U.S.
It is extremely stressful being in that ambiguous state, being in, feeling really vulnerable and really, helpless.
For 4 years, Samia Iyer was a product designer at the ride-sharing app Lyft. She has 60 days to find a job or go back to India.
On the day of layoffs, you're instantly logged out of all your applications, all your systems, all your apps, all your documents.
4 years of work that you were simply instantaneously logged out of?
Yes.
Nobody to call to say, hey, can you just give me a couple of days to download some stuff?
The moment you're laid off, you have till the end of the day.
So what did you do?
I mean, I had a lot of exit formalities to complete. So that took most of my day.
And all that time you're thinking, how do I retrieve
work?
The work you've done for your portfolio.
Right. It was driving me crazy. I had to compromise on a lot of great companies because everyone instantly wants to see work.
And she couldn't access any of hers. So massive disruption in tech, massive layoffs, a harbinger of deep recession?
You know, Silicon Valley has burned down many times. And every time it burns down, it reinvents itself. But this time it isn't a forest fire. It's just a hedge trimming.
Longtime Silicon Valley entrepreneur Vivek Wadhwa.
This is nothing like the dot-com burst. The dot-com burst had global consequences and it was huge. It set the economy back for years to come. This is just a minor correction.
Economist Betsy Stevenson agrees.
What I'm seeing is a sector that hired more than most other sectors did during the pandemic. They're pulling back a little bit with layoffs, and we're still dealing with monthly jobs reports that are showing us job growth that's bigger than almost any single month we had prior to the pandemic. So I don't think there's any reason to worry that there are some people losing their jobs because, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of others gaining jobs.
Of course, that doesn't make it any easier for those workers laid off. But Stevenson actually has a positive big picture reframing.
When the pandemic began, technology was our savior. We turned to technology to be able to work from home, to be able to shop from home, to be able to talk to our doctors from home. But I do think that, you know, it's run its course in terms of that growth and the fact that that is resulting in the tech sector having layoffs, to me, symbolizes that we've reached the end of this pandemic era.
I actually think that the recent wave is a bit overdue and maybe good for the rest of the economy.
And there's actually an upside to the layoffs, claims techno-optimist Eric Brynjolfsson, who runs the Digital Economy Lab at Stanford.
There's a ton of really great tech talent that's been tied up in activities that may not be creating that much value, especially I'm thinking of crypto. Meanwhile, the real need is to have tech folks go and transform the rest of America, manufacturing, retailing, finance, healthcare, most of all. And we need to unleash some of the talent in that part of the economy.
I put this to the talent itself.
I think that's possible. I have been looking at some job opportunities in the healthcare sector, for example. So it's definitely somewhere that I may end up.
I was always more passionate to be in healthcare or something that has to do with like food and health services or something that has to do with education and learning, etc. So now I feel that it's a good time to recalibrate and rethink about the future.
In sum, a rough ride for sure for laid off tech talent, especially from abroad. But for the economy, and eventually even the talent maybe, just maybe, a harbinger of health. For the PBS NewsHour, this is Paul Solman, reporting, although still sometimes remotely, at what we all pray is the dawn of the post-pandemic era.
More than a year after being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, journalist Maria Ressa still faces a series of criminal charges in her native country, the Philippines. She's the founder and CEO of Rappler.com and has spent much time reporting on former President Rodrigo Duterte's regime and the war on drugs. In a new memoir, she shares a personal account of her unrelenting work uncovering the truth and holding power to account. I spoke with her a short time ago about her book, How to Stand Up to a Dictator, The Fight for Our Future. Maria Ressa, thank you very much for joining us. And this book is about how to stand up to a dictator, but it's also very much your personal story. You were born and spent 10 years in the Philippines, and you moved to the United States for another 10 years. How did that dual country coming of age shape you?
I think in a lot of ways, it
created a great kind of setup for being a journalist. When I was here in the U.S., when we landed, I could really barely speak English. So my teachers remembered the year when I was strangely quiet, and they kept teaching me music, which was fantastic. And then when I was graduating college, somehow it felt like I wasn't completely American, right? So I thought, let me figure out what being Filipino meant. So I applied for a Fulbright going the other way. I went back to the Philippines, and it was supposed to be a year, and I just never left the Philippines, never left Southeast Asia. And then when I came back to America, I realized, oh my gosh, every time I'm with Americans, I feel more Filipino. When I'm with Filipinos, I feel more American. So you're kind of part of both, but you're part of neither, which then set up being a reporter for me.
But where did the courage that you had to summon for what, your entire adult life as a journalist in the Philippines, working for CNN, where I first met you, where did that courage come from?
I think one of the things I tried to do early on, when I first was an immigrant kid, the only brown kid in my classroom when I walked in, there are lessons I learned from that time period that still reverberated today through the time I was with CNN. You know, they were about standing up to a bully, because you can replace how to stand up to a dictator with how to stand up to a bully. It's the exact same thing. How to embrace your fear. Like, I realized that it's our own fears that get in our way, and how to embrace your fear. Well, like, this one I remember was, I didn't know early on what a pajama party was. So my classmate invited me to it, and and I asked my mom, I was like, Mom, is that a party you wear pajamas? And she was like, yes. So we show up and we're rounding, we're pulling up in front of the house, and it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and all the kids were playing kickball and they were not wearing pajamas. So I,
such a great story.
And then I got out of the car, and then my classmate came and helped me, right? So you kind of just, I learned to confront my fear. I learned to move forward and trust someone will be there. And then I hope when it's my turn to help someone else that I will be there.
And you've cemented your reputation. You worked in, as we said, in journalism in the Philippines for CNN. And then you created, a little over a decade ago, this forward-leaning news website called Rappler, earning the ire of the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, while he was in power. Now, he's now out of power.
Yeah.
But he considered you a threat.
Yeah, I don't really know why. I think that meant he just considered accountability journalism a threat. He had attacked three different news groups, the largest newspaper, the largest broadcaster, and then we were the largest online news site. And we were the third attacked, but we didn't buckle because we had no other corporate interests. You know, it was very easy to push up. This is a man who just wanted to make everyone afraid of him. And I think I was too old. By that time, I was in my 50s. You know, being a breaking news war zone correspondent is the best training for that, because you sit there, and regardless of what's happening around you, you distill to three bullet points and you say it like it is. And that's kind of the way I dealt with this administration. We kept doing our jobs.
And along the way, you won the Nobel Peace Prize just in the last year or so. And now there's a new president of the Philippines, Fernando Marcos Jr., Bongbong.
Yeah.
Are you still, I mean, there are still warrants out for you.
In order to be here, I have to ask court approvals. Yeah. Now one has gone all the way to the Supreme Court, the court of last resorts. Sometimes I get approval, sometimes I don't. That is also, I think, calculated. And you really don't know how much you value your freedom until you begin to lose it. Now, I don't want to read the tea leaves. I want to just keep doing my job. And I think in general, forget what's happening in the Philippines. To me, what was more damaging, because this is what I demanded an end for in 2016, the impunity, not just of Duterte, but also of Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook.
Yeah.
That was something we had no control over in the Philippines, but it enabled the rise of Duterte, it enabled the rise of Marcos.
And that's what I want to ask you about, because now you are virtually on a crusade
Oh my gosh.
To tell the world about what social media is doing to democracy.
It's what I've lived through. You know, and it is both a blessing and a curse to be the target of attacks, of information operations. You're the only one who feels it. You're attacked. These exponential attacks are meant to pound you to silence. But the flip side of it is if you're a reporter, you sit there and you look at the data, and that started something different for us. It was investigative journalism. And it was just like what following the terrorists after 9/11, this one is a different type. It's insidious manipulation, and the data proves it. That's what I lean on, the facts. It's evidence-based. It is bad for us.
Your message to Americans watching this is what? Because, I mean, we're having our own debate in this country about social media, but you're saying, you know, that it's a warning sign what happened in your country.
Look at what's happened to us, because it's coming for you. This is what I said in 2016. When January 6th happened, it was Silicon Valley sins coming home to roost. The fact that there is no legislation to prevent this insidious manipulation. I mean, think about it like this, right? If you have kids, would you tell them to keep lying? You reward the lies. That is what gets the greatest distribution online. It's lies laced with anger and hate, fear, us against them. If you do this all the time, what kinds of societies do we create?
So many important warnings, stories and warnings in this book by Maria Ressa, How to Stand Up to a Dictator, The Fight for Our Future. It's so good to see you again. Thank you, Maria.
So wonderful to see you, Judy. Thanks for having me.
More Muslim Americans ran for political office during this year's midterms than ever before, 153 in total. That's according to a report from the Council on American-Islamic Relations and Jetpack Resource Center. And more of them won their races than in any past election. Jeff Bennett has more.
Judy, this year's elections proved to be historic, with 89 Muslim American candidates winning local, state, federal, and judicial seats across 25 states, according to that report. Our next guest, Rua Roman, is among them. She's the first known Muslim woman elected to the Georgia House of Representatives and the first Palestinian American elected to any office in the state of Georgia. Welcome to the NewsHour. It's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Before you became a politician, you were a longtime volunteer in Democratic Party politics in the state of Georgia. It's one thing to be civically engaged. It's another thing to decide to run for office yourself. What motivated your decision to launch a campaign?
I did not decide to run for office is the best way to explain that. I had done a lot of work with civic organizations focused on empowering and mobilizing historically marginalized communities like my Muslim community. And one of those, Georgia Muslim Voter Project, had a training with some local partners to teach people how to run for office. My friend had asked me to attend to support the program and give them feedback on what they should be adding, since I've been doing that sort of work for a long time in Georgia. A reporter was there. She writes a great article about the importance of civic engagement for minorities in the state. But she started out with, Rua Roman is contemplating a run for office, which I was not, but it was a fair assumption since I was at this training. And my community was so excited, they asked me to run. And 15 days later, we launched my campaign.
You are an immigrant. You're the granddaughter of Palestinian refugees. You're a Muslim woman who wears a hijab. What has the road to political office been like for you?
It's been long, and it's been unexpected sometimes, but it's also been one built by those who've come before me. The woman who ran in my seat 4 years ago is also a Muslim woman. Her name is Aisha Yaqub. She founded the Georgia Muslim Voter Project. She's currently the executive director of Asian American Advocacy Fund. And my win is a result of that investment, that almost decade-long investment by the Muslim community, by other minority groups in Georgia that said, hey, we're tired of these decisions being made about us, but without our voices. It's time we were at those tables. And so for years now, these organizations have worked to build the infrastructure needed for campaigns like mine.
Is that what you think accounts for the historic number of Muslim Americans who are not just running for elected office, but in this last election, won?
Absolutely. We have been able to show over years now that as the community continues to invest time, of course, money, of course, but also their vote, their civic participation, their work in coalitions with other organizations, that we can make history happen. And that's exactly what happened in Georgia.
You ran on a platform focused on increasing public school funding, tackling Medicaid, expanding voting rights. How does your background, how does your experience inform your approach to policymaking?
I've been doing this work in Georgia for almost 10 years. I've learned how the General Assembly works here. I have the knowledge and the experience to be able to come to the table and say, look, there's a better way of doing this. There's a way of doing this that will benefit Georgians across the board, not just the select few. And I'm really excited to be able to bring that expertise to the table in a way that says we don't have to turn everything into who's going to make the best, you know, headline today. It's who can pass the best piece of legislation to help the most Georgians. And that's why we ran the campaign the way that we did this year, which is focusing on putting public service back into politics, focusing on the issues, and making sure that we're able to reach voters and talk to voters at every avenue that we could.
In an election year, most of the attention is focused on lawmakers. It's focused on politicians at the national level. You have said that state lawmakers shouldn't be overlooked. Tell me more about that.
Absolutely. I always remind people that every piece of legislation that either you love on a national level or absolutely hate on a national level started in a state legislature somewhere around the country. At the end of the day, these laws start right here. You know, in our case, whether it's the heartbeat bill or, you know, other pieces of legislation as it pertains to immigration, as it pertains to taxes, even as it pertains to healthcare. We saw this with Obamacare. These things always start at the state level. And us as state representatives are the ones that you can reach out to say, look, here's how this personally impacts me. And your voice is now part of a much smaller group of people. So it's even more powerful.
Royal Roman, just elected to the Georgia State House of Representatives. Thanks so much for your time and for your insight.
Thanks for having me.
The president halts a railroad strike, lawmakers shield gay marriage, and Democrats shake up the road to the White House. To consider this week's news, the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, associate editor for The Washington Post. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
I'm so glad you had a good Thanksgiving meet. You just reassured me that was the case. Let's start, Jonathan, with the newest news, and that is what the Democratic Party is doing. They took a vote today. They are moving up South Carolina. This is the primary calendar in 2024. It's a ways away. It's more, a little more than a year away, mm-hmm. but with big consequences. What does it say to you? South Carolina, Michigan earlier, Iowa.
Well, right. It's more than just moving South Carolina up. It's a total reorganization of the calendar and cramming a lot in the month of February. So with South Carolina going first, clearly what the party wants to do is make sure that the first state that votes in a presidential primary election is one that demographically looks more like the country than, say, Iowa. And with, if memory serves, about a quarter of the electorate in South Carolina is African American. And so that makes a lot of sense. And I think there are a lot of people within the Democratic Party, especially after the debacle of the Iowa caucuses in 2020, were really pushing for a state more representative of the country, having a say early, if not first, about who the nominee of the party should be.
And David, this is something pushed by President Biden. What do you make of it?
Well, if anybody had any doubts that Biden is running for re-election, I think they were ended today. Like, he like took over the whole primary process. The state to go first is the state he's probably most likely to win of all the 50 states, which it propelled him last time. Mm-hmm. And he just said, no, we're going to do it my way. And whatever you guys have been talking about, that's nice, we're going to do it my way. And he has prevailed. And so, you know, I think for the reasons Jonathan said, it's not only ruthless politics, but it's also probably the right thing to do. The one lament, because we want states that are a little more diverse up front, the one thing I do lament, aside from the fact that I like going to Iowa and New Hampshire, it's very comfortable and beautiful. The people are very earnest. But I lament the possibility that it will end small-scale retail politics. Yeah. Because in Iowa, New Hampshire, a candidate like Pete Buttigieg can come there and just live in Des Moines and really 10, 15 people at a time can build a following. Now there are going to be big states. They're going to be all at once. It'll help the candidates who have a lot of money, a and a lot of name recognition. And so an outsider, a Pete Buttigieg, frankly, a Barack Obama, will, I think, probably find a little harder to come from relative nowhere and then ride a tide.
I remember Jimmy Carter, who I covered a long time ago, sleeping in people's guest bedrooms all over the state of Iowa. But what I'm really going to miss, Jonathan, Iowa State Fair, the butter sculptures. Big competition.
I once saw the Last Supper sculpted in butter, life-size. It was a highlight of my life.
So I'm trying to get an image of that in my head. A lot was going on this week. Congress back in session, and they moved pretty quickly to address this rail strike, imposing a settlement on rail workers, bipartisan. What do you make of what they did? Is it good for the country? Is it good for the rail workers?
It is good for the country in that if there had been a rail strike, that would have hit 30% of the economy. It would have ground things to a standstill right at the time when American consumers, when Americans are most sensitive, and that is when they're doing all of their holiday shopping. I mean, remember the supply chain conversations we were having a year ago this time, people losing their minds that they couldn't get their gifts. This had to be done. I think this president of all presidents is the one who was able to cobble together the deal in the first place that then got rejected. It's a federal law that makes it possible for the president and Congress to impose this deal on rail workers. But the issues that the rail workers were about to strike over are not insignificant. Paid sick leave is something that is, that's something that they need to discuss. That's something that is not an unreasonable ask, especially when rail companies are sitting on billions upon billions of dollars in profits last year. You know, the workers had no leverage, unlike, say, fast food workers or other workers around the country for whom a strike is that leverage point to get what they want and what they need.
And they didn't get the paid sick leave.
Yeah, and the administration said there could have been 675,000 job losses costing billions of dollars a day. Nonetheless, I'm a little, not that I'm singing solidarity for every morning, but basically, the government took away the workers' right to strike or their ability to strike. And that imbalances the negotiation going. If the railroad companies think, oh, well, the government will step in and take away the ability to strike, then that alters how they're going to negotiate. And so it alters the balance. So I worry a little about the sort of the moral hazard of government stepping in. And it reminds me in sort of an inverse case. I thought the bailout of the banks in 2008 was the right thing to do. Nonetheless, it is clear that the moral hazard, the way the government behaved, had long-term moral and cultural effects on this country because people thought the system is rigged. And if workers decide, if we lose the ability to strike, then the system is a little rigged against us, and that could lead to some level of cynicism and distrust.
But that's why this law needs to be changed. It's not like the president and Congress said, well, we'll just make you take it just by fiat. The law says that that's what they have the power to do that. So to do what you're saying, David, that, you know, they need to change the law to give those rail workers the opportunity to strike.
And as you were saying, weighing it against what it would mean for the economy if this went on, if it wasn't resolved. Another thing the two parties were able to come together on, Jonathan, was on protecting same-sex and interracial marriage in America. What does this amount to? What's the significance?
Well, I'm smiling from ear to ear as someone, an out gay married man in an interracial marriage. I'm doubly covered. Look, in the grand scheme of things, this is a terrific thing to have to ensure that if Obergefell is rendered unconstitutional, my marriage will still be recognized by the Supreme Court decision that legalized same-sex marriage. If Obergefell goes away, though, this is where the problem I have with the law. My marriage is protected. But if my husband and I move back to North Dakota, where he's from, same-sex marriage is banned in the Constitution and by state law. If Obergefell goes away, same as when Dobbs overturned Roe v. Wade. Instantly, 35 states ban same-sex marriage. So if we meet friends, a same-sex couple that wants to get married in North Dakota, they would have to leave the state, go to New York, go to California, go somewhere where marriage is, same-sex marriage is legal, and then come home and the state would be forced, because of this law, to recognize their marriage. That is a burden, an unfair burden, on couples who all they want to do is solemnize their relationships and also protect their families, because more often than not, these same-sex couples want to get married either to start a family or to protect the family that they have. And if Congress really wants to do something to protect LGBTQ Americans and certainly same-sex married couples, they would pass the Equality Act. It's out of the House, it's been sitting in the Senate. All they need to do is pass it in the lame duck, and things would be great.
So how much of a step forward is this?
I think it's a very significant step forward. First, in the matter of justice, you know, there, I think there are now over a billion same-sex married, a million. So we're going to take away those people's marriages? Like, is that pro-family? So I don't think, you know, I don't think that would be just a tremendous wrong to do that. And as Joe Biden says, love is love, and people should get married. I think the thing I'm also very hopeful about is that this represents a path out of some of the culture wars. So the history of this is that in 2008, the LDS Church campaigned against gay marriage in a California proposition. The blowback was so strong, they said, wait, we got to rethink this issue. So they went to the LGBT community in Utah and said, let's have a compromise. Gay marriage will be on the books, but what's our religious freedom will be protected. So the government will not take away our tax status. And so they made this compromise. And this is sort of what happened here. So the National Association for Evangelical supports this, the CCCU, all the Christian colleges support this, because they were terrified that they would get their tax status taken away because of their religious beliefs. And so this was a group of people coming together across the culture war saying, what you want is to protect your marriages. What we need is to not have our tax status take away. We want religious freedom. And so they both got what they want. They did a deal. And that's the way politics should work.
We are, I see your face,
no,
Jonathan.
I
see the look on your face.
Well, only because, I mean, the religious exemptions offend me personally, because there are some people who are going to use their personal beliefs and hide behind religion to discriminate against people like me and families like mine. And there would be no legal recourse for me and my husband or other these million same-sex married couples in the United States to hold someone accountable for not giving us the services we should constitutionally be able to avail ourselves of. That's all.
I'm sympathetic to that, but as I understand this law, if you went to a baker and said, we want you to bake our wedding cake, he still has to bake the wedding cake, as I understand that. It's mostly what they were worried about is their view of scripture is that God doesn't support gay marriage or same-sex marriages, and if they don't want to be forced to perform gay marriages or face losing their tax status. And I do not agree with them, but there are a lot of people in this country who believe in scripture and believe this is what scripture says. And I think it's a willing sacrifice to give people their religious freedom so we can live together.
And to be clear, it's both those things. It's not putting their tax exempt status to risk, but also not putting themselves at risk for denying service, i.e. foster care or other services in all sorts of institutions.
Only a few seconds left, but I did want to say it's a little over a week since former President Trump had dinner with Nick Fuentes, the known neo-Nazi, and every other, I think, noun you can say that isn't positive. We asked members of Congress for their reaction, and many of them are still not commenting on it. Interesting.
There's a glass half full or half empty. A lot did not comment, but more than usual, Republicans condemn Trump, more than average.
It's reprehensible. If a Republican is in leadership, they should have been out there within hours of finding out about this dinner. This is what's leading to the corrosion of political discourse. And in our society, we have people who are openly anti-Semitic and no consequences. That's outrageous.
Yeah. Tough to think about. Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks, thank you both.
Thanks, Judy.
And we'll be back shortly with a rapper and actor who is encouraging fans to find their purpose in life. But first, Take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps to keep programs like ours on the air. For those stations staying with us, the Great Salt Lake in Utah is shrinking because of population growth and an ongoing mega drought worsened by climate change. Stephanie Tsai explored the lake earlier this year to learn more. Here's a reprise of her report.
Reaching the waters of the Great Salt Lake from almost any direction these days is a hike, and Brian Footen is carrying a heavy load. Founder of the Earth Views Conservation Society, he's equipped a kayak with cameras and sensors, mobile tools to map the receding shoreline.
This is going to log water quality data every 10 seconds, things like temperature, dissolved oxygen.
Satellite images capture the extent of the lake shrinkage since 1985, but Footen says there's nothing like bringing the public right to its dwindling surface through his interactive website.
It doesn't take, you know, charts and graphs and big scientific reports to tell this story, right? All you have to do is go out there and look.
And so we did, paddling through shallow waters with an astonishing vacancy of life. This northern arm of the lake is already forever changed by human decisions. The red tint is a result of extremely high salinity. It was choked off from the rest of the lake years ago to build a railroad causeway.
The Great Salt Lake is drying up. Climate change is responsible. You know, developers are responsible. And it just goes over top of people's heads, right?
Sure.
And so what we're doing is using this imagery as a way to kind of go, wow, look at this. This is really happening.
Footen also sends the data he collects to biologist Bonnie Baxter.
You know, the water is way out there now.
We meet her on the southern end of the Great Salt Lake. It is eerily quiet and smells of brine.
I feel like we're in the middle of just a dead zone here.
If we see larvae in the water, or pupal casings, there's Sharpies to write on.
Baxter brings researchers from Westminster College to gather specimens weekly.
These mounds should be covered with mats of microorganisms that do photosynthesis and bring the sun's energy into the lake system. But you can see that they're dry and they're not green and they're out of the water. Even the ones in the water are not healthy because they're too salty. The ones out of the water are too dry.
The mounds are called microbialites.
This is the foundation of the Great Salt Lake ecosystem, and we're seeing it crash and die right before our eyes.
The lake is at its lowest level in history. As a result, it's becoming too salty, even for species adapted to high salinity.
We're not finding any fly pupa today. That's terrifying.
Brine flies feed the millions of birds that flock here, as do brine shrimp, which are also harvested. It's just one part of the $1.3 billion economic output of the Great Salt Lake. To understand why the lake is drying up, you have to zoom out to the surrounding areas of the lake's namesake, Salt Lake City.
The state of Utah as a whole is the fastest growing state in the nation. Yellow is the new green.
Aaron Mendenhall is the mayor, a Democrat.
We are absolutely committed to saving this lake with whatever we can. Last year, that was 2.6 billion gallons of water that Salt Lakers conserved. This year, it's already up to 2.9 billion gallons.
The city's achieved that not by mandating water restrictions, but by raising water rates about 15% a year and implementing a tiered rate structure.
So the more you consume, those water rates go up even faster.
While conservation efforts by residents of Salt Lake City will definitely help, it may not be enough. Two-thirds of the water in the Great Salt Lake watershed goes to agriculture, including the water from the Bear River.
It irrigates the farms and ranches whose yields Utah families have relied on since Mormon pioneers settled the region in the 1800s, fulfilling, they believed, a biblical prophecy to make the desert blossom.
I don't know what normal looks like anymore. It's been a long time since we've had good winters and good moisture.
Joel Ferry has a unique perspective. A fifth-generation Utah cattle rancher, he's also a former Republican state representative and now the director of the state's Department of Natural Resources.
Water in the state of Utah is a prior appropriation, so whoever used it first has the first right to use it today. And a lot of those rights belong to farmers.
Is it time for that to change?
Well, no, I mean, we have laws and we have structure. So what it's time for us to do is to implement more conservation measures.
Bipartisan support for conserving water for the Great Salt Lake led to a dozen laws enacted this year by the Republican-dominated state government. The reforms, among many provisions, do away with use-or-lose water policies.
We passed legislation that me as a farmer, I can say, you know what, I'm going to take my water, I'm going to put it in the river, and I'll receive a beneficial use, which totally changes the mindset of that use it or lose it. I might say, you know what, wheat is not worth very much. I don't want it. I'm going to get some compensation if I leave it in the river.
One of the biggest worries is that the Great Salt Lake will go the way of others before it, not just drying up and ceasing to be a source of water, but becoming a source of poison.
Biologist Bonnie Baxter says more than 40% of the lake bed is no longer covered by water and could turn to dust.
We're likely to see an increase in dust storm as we expose more shorelines. We're likely to see more dust.
And that's toxic dust because
yes.
There is arsenic and heavy metal
exactly.
In this lake bed.
Right.
It is only one reason why for hours a day, Brian Footen paddles along the lake's shoreline, documenting its disappearance.
I think one of the big stories that's being missed in the talk about the climate and the drought and the agriculture and the development in Salt Lake is that this is a unique ecosystem on the planet. There's nothing else like it.
And that in itself, he says, is a reason for saving it. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai at the Great Salt Lake in Utah.
Here is a question that a Houston-born, first-generation Nigerian-American artist asked himself, and then others, as he has built his following through his music and his acting. What's your purpose? Jeffrey Brown went to Houston to learn more about the man who was just nominated for a Grammy in the Best New Artist category. That's for our Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
Stay focused, be consistent and disciplined. Most of all, find your purpose.
Lord, forgive me, I'll be putting in work.
It's a mantra for Tobey Wigwe, what he wants to demonstrate through his music.
I feel like it's all about making purpose popular in every aspect of the term, like living out our life, the entertainment, the music, whatever it is that we're doing is centered around making purpose popular.
Yeah. Look at my black skin!
On stage at music festivals like Austin City Limits.
You can't bring in the new until you process the old.
And on screen as an actor in the acclaimed Netflix series Mo, the show created by Palestinian-American comedian Mo Ammer about his life in a multi-ethnic Texas community. As his hometown newspaper, the Houston Chronicle, put it recently, the 35-year-old Wigwe is everywhere right now. But his heart remains in Houston. And that's where we met him, at the White Oak Music Hall, rehearsing for an upcoming date in London. As it's been from the start, this is a family affair. His wife, Martika, beside him on stage, their three young children, aged 3, 2, and 1, always nearby, dancing while Daddy sings. Musicians, dancers, support team, all local, all friends.
It's the only way I know to operate, because I didn't have any foreknowledge of how else to operate in the industry. Mm-hmm. So I just utilized the resources and people that were in my actual life. It's people that I built trust with, and I just prefer it that way. It's sweeter like that to me.
The original all-consuming purpose for Wigwe?
It's intercepted.
Football.
Go Wigwe, scores, Hornard, Texas.
He was a star linebacker in high school and at the University of North Texas, and had the NFL in his sights until a foot injury his senior year ended that dream.
I swear I've been broke way too long.
Instead, he developed a plan that's guided him since. His new purpose would be helping others find theirs. Seeing many young people adrift, some into drugs and violence, he started a nonprofit to work in local schools using what he called edutainment, entertainment education.
I just used a lot of the natural skill sets that I had. The charisma, not being scared to speak in public and do skits and all that type of stuff to really try to motivate students and kids to just get on the path to figure out what their purpose is. Not you come here and we're gonna tell you what your purpose is, but just on some like really like you should start trying to figure that out early.
Wigwe is a first-generation child of Nigerian immigrants. His full first name is Tobe Chukwu, which means praise God. And he credits part of his drive and motivation to that heritage, as in his description of his parents' approach to school report cards.
Let me tell you how B stands for bonehead, C is for can't you get an A, D is for dummy, F is for fools, and fools can no longer stay in this house. But A is for appreciation. Yeah. That's what you're showing when you go and get A's, because now you're showing that you appreciate my sacrifice, you appreciate all the things that I've done to make your life special.
Try Jesus, don't try me.
Another driving force, his Christian faith, heard in one of his biggest hits to date, Try Jesus.
The fact that we was five kids living in one room.
In fact, he first gained attention and built his audience with what he called Get Twisted Sundays, a weekly music video posted on social media with the force of a sermon, often centered on the power of black family and love. Starting from scratch, he's involved in everything, from designing the clothes, to the choreography, to the marketing.
What I landed on was I'm just gonna market myself as myself. And I'm going to put out...
Wait a minute, you're going to market yourself as yourself? I mean, that sounds pretty normal, but maybe it's not in the in the music business?
Yeah, it's really not. You would be surprised. I've encountered in this industry a lot of people doing stuff that ain't really them. And I'm like, oh, I thought you was like this because you portray this type of character. And it's like, nah, I'm really not. No knock to anybody who does it like that. Me personally, it's just my art and my real life are like synonymous.
The music served the message, and both took off.
I said, arrest the killers of Breonna Taylor.
A short and simple track about the police killing of Breonna Taylor went viral.
Southside, we roll on choppers.
He performed a tribute to Houston on NPR's nationally renowned Tiny Desk series.
That's all we're trying to do, is to get you to understand, like, I know there's way that music is done. There's ways that life is done, but you don't have to necessarily subscribe to a way that you don't fully agree with or a way that the world does it that makes you feel like, yo, this is the only way. You can branch out, do your own thing, stand on your own principles, stand on your own beliefs, and do what you believe in.
For now, there's more acting to come. Tobe Wigwe will make his big screen debut in the next Transformers film due next spring.
Hey, Houston, you ready?
And there's lots more music.
Look, dog, I'm in.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in Houston.
In other words, we're going to be hearing a lot more about him. And on the NewsHour online, how a famous children's book author is trying to inspire a new generation of authors by building a library for school kids in Malawi. That story is at pbs.org/newshour. Be sure to join Yamiche Alcindor and her panel on Washington Week later tonight, right here on PBS. And tune in to PBS News Weekend, that's tomorrow. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.